Science can't explain everything. Just because you can't see me doesn't mean I'm not here.
Thank you for joining me, everyone, and welcome to Paranormal Encounters podcast series. My name is Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz. I am the host and the producer of this show. Sit back, grab yourself some popcorn, and let's get started.
Be careful what you wish for.
Good evening, everyone. As they say, we better finish up part two tonight of the Steve Stockton interview. And if you missed part one, please go back and listen to that one first. Let's get started.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
How many items did you pick up when you were, I'm not going to use the word investigating, mesmerized by your play in that area? How many, you noted that there were some things that you had found, belt buckle, I can't remember the name of these clay balls that they had back in those days.
Yeah, they called them the little mini balls.
The mini clay balls,
found
right.
Some of those, but yeah. Also found arrowheads and things like that down there, pieces of nap flint.
Yeah.
So that area had been in use for a long time. I found a lot of things. I didn't find the buckle. A guy came one time and wanted to look with a metal detector. My dad let him, and he found a CSA belt buckle down there by the springs.
Right, and I'm just wondering about when, well, first of all, you're a beacon. We'll just get that out of the way. And for those of you who we've been chatting about this, we have high frequencies. I'm a beacon. We pick up things that other people don't either pay attention to, or they just come to us very readily and easily because, for some reason we attract this stuff.
It's an empathic thing because it doesn't have to be the dead or spirits or anything like that. Right. I go into a nursing home and it feels like everybody in there is pulling energy out of me, reaching.
Yes.
Me.
Yeah.
Before I learned how to kind of block that off to a degree. It would deplete you. I came out of places before. I went to Children's Hospital one time when my daughter was first born. That's been 32 years ago this week. She was jaundiced. So they said, we're just going to keep her overnight under some ultraviolet lights here, make sure she's okay. Mm-hmm. And I spent the night there in the room with her mother. And I couldn't wait to get out of that place. That was, I felt some of the darkest, most evil energy there that I've ever felt.
Yeah.
And it was like in my mind's eye, I could see like a black cloud hovering over East Tennessee Children's Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like something was there drawing the pain and the suffering and the misery of those little children. Because,
right.
You know, that's the purest people, the purest humans are the children, and their suffering, you know, therefore would be, if it was something evil or something dark, it would count that as more, I think, than just a grown person or whatever. Because, you know, there's a burn ward there and kids with brain tumors and things like that. And just you could hear kids screaming and crying all night long. And I hope I never have to go back to the children's hospital.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the thing is that closing this stuff off from us is not always very easy. I mean, once you're kind of marked, or they know that we have a, you know, this ability or whatever. Sometimes even in the most innocent terms, they come to us wanting to relay or present something. Back in my, you know, when I first started really going at this, you know, because I felt, you know, telepathically I hear messages. And at the age of 4, I was clairaudient and, you know, I guess a little clairvoyant, because I used to see dream of plane crashes and disasters and all this stuff. And then on TV the very next day, it would be showing this. And I thought, this is very, very odd, you know. But as a 4-year-old, as a 5-year-old, you don't think, oh my God, you know. After a while, though, I thought I was causing this stuff. And so, yeah, I mean,
I've been there. Yeah, I've seen stuff.
You're thinking like that.
Just when I'm just drifting off to sleep, it's almost like that's a vision. I saw a construction site one time, a pile of concrete pipes stacked in a little pyramid, and they weren't banded or anything. They broke loose, rolled down a hill, and I saw a guy crushed to death. I mean, I saw the aftermath, everything. And I sat straight up in bed, and I just dozed off, and my my wife at the time was like, you look like you've seen a ghost. And I said, I think I just saw somebody become one. And I knew it was somewhere in the south because of the red clay mud. But it could be a construction site anywhere. I didn't see any landmarks. I didn't see any logos or anything. I saw people, you know, wearing construction hats and stuff. And there was digging equipment and things there. And about, I think it was a few weeks later, I heard about a similar accident, or actually an identical accident that had happened in another part of Tennessee where that same thing had happened. There was an unsecured pyramid of concrete pipe, drainage pipes. They collapsed and rolled over a guy and killed him. And I thought, you know, why would I see things like that if there's nothing I can do to stop it? You know, at least if I'm going to have these visions, let me see a license plate, or let me see a landmark, or let me see something so that I can maybe warn somebody. But that's just not the way it works. And what my grandmother, now not about that particular incident, because that was after she was long dead. But when I'd ask her about seeing things that other people didn't, she said, sometimes these things you see, there's not anything that can be done to stop it. She said, you may see it, and you're there as a witness or to document it, whether you actually see it or whether you see it in a different realm. She said, but there's things that are going to be no matter what. And one of the things she used to talk about was, she said, if you're in the river, you can swim against it, or you can swim with it. You're going to end up in the same place. It's up to you to decide how tired you are when you get there. She was a pistol like that. But that was the way she kind of put me at ease. She said, you know, you're just, there's things, some things you might be able to help, some things you might be able to warn people about, but there's stuff that just is going to be one way or the other. Well, and I've heard stories about that where somebody would, you know, have a premonition and tell somebody, don't get on that plane, it's going to crash. They would cancel their flight, delay it till another day, get on that plane, and then it crashed. You know, so it's just like,
were you listening to my show last time? Because that's the story that I told.
I mean, you're going,
well, he's having a psychic moment right now, because for the last 5 minutes, I'm sitting here going, I'm going to tell him about this plane situation.
I think I picked up on it.
You did, because the situation was, someone went to a psychic. This is years ago. I'm talking years ago. When I first started getting intrigued by psychics, you know, and all that, and years ago, a psychic had told somebody, there is going to come a point where you're going to find yourself delayed, and you're going to rush through the airport, and you're thinking you're going to miss your plane, and you're just going to barely make that plane. But that's the point, she says, I don't want you to get on that plane, because that plane is going to crash. Now, come on. Here's the problem with this whole thing. Number one, is she right or is she not right? What are you supposed to say? This plane is going to crash. I am not going to get on this plane. Okay, stop the plane. It's going to crash. Think about all of the things that that interrupts along the way, financially, this, that, people's vacations, you name it, you name it. Okay, fine. It crashed. All right.
what are you supposed to do then? I told you I was trying. There have been situations where people have tried to forewarn people like that, by the way, and they just, they have to pass it off. They have to count it as, oh my God, well, forget it, you know? And, I mean,
I've heard that some of the airlines even have like a tip line, a psychic tip line, where if you can call it and they'll ask you questions, you know, what did it look like this? Did you see any tail numbers or any identifying marks? Do you know where it was going or whatever? But, you know, in this day and age, I would be hesitant to call in, because then they think you're going to do something.
Exactly.
And I've heard of stories like that, like, you know, the missing persons and stuff that we look into, where there has been psychics that told the police exactly pinpoint where to go find a body, and then they'll go arrest the person. Well, like, you knew where the body was, so you must have had something to do with it.
You must be my twin. I've told that story too, by the way, on my podcast. Yes. I've worked in law for 8 years, and the number one thing that, and I've told people this all the time, is this. You don't want to, I mean, you'd want to go to the police and say, I see the body here, there, whatever, and da-da-da, and you give descriptions and all that sort of thing. And then the first person that they look at is you. They look at the person giving the report. They don't go, they may follow up on the tip, but let's say it's true. And they do find the body, right? Well, unfortunately, they look back at the person who was the informant of that situation, where the informant was trying to just do a genuine helpful act all along. That's correct. That's right. That makes me reticent.
I've had dreams. I won't mention any names, but there's a young boy that's been missing out here in Oregon, and I'm not from here. I've only lived here about 10 years, but there's a little boy that's been missing from here for so long, and I've had dreams of where he is. It's a culvert, a drain culvert. He's in a really thick black plastic bag that's weighted down with rocks and shoved in that culvert.
Oh my.
But I'm not going to go to the police and say, oh, I know where this kid's at, because then they,
well, they come back and they look at you.
Have some explaining to do. Yeah. How did you know this?
Well, it's everybody has their, I've tried to explain it like this. So you've got the doctors who have their theories on how things need to go, their processes. You've got the police and how their theories and how things need to go when they process things. And you've got, you know, the lawyers that do things a certain way. So everybody has their certain way, right? You know, when is the last time you've gone to a doctor and you say, I need you to check? Well, here's a good example. I'd like to have a CAT scan done, please, or an MRI, because I think I've got alien implants in me. Okay, let's use that one as a good basis. And then what do you do? First of all, your insurance would never go for a personal recommendation. If it's elective, you're paying for it out of your own pocket, and that can cost a lot of money right there. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And next thing you know, if they look at you, I just remember when I was talking with one of my, and it was an allergist, because I had, not to alarm anyone, but it was just my body is so sensitive that even though technically in the end, everything finally worked out okay, I was very sensitive to the first shot. And so I ended up in an allergist office, and I was trying to tell him a little bit about this, that, and whatever, because he was into the paranormal. Well, as soon as I started getting a little bit too much into asking this question about how a handprint ended up on my body, blood red, crooked hand, this, that, da-da-da, upside down, the conversation ended like lickety split on a dime. And the reason why? You don't talk about that stuff with people that come into your office and go, oh, by the way, last night I had a handprint show up on my body and it wasn't mine. You know, so it's very, isn't that, don't you find it very fascinating and interesting?
Yeah, I do, especially people like that, where it has to be something that's reproducible or something that there's a been some sort of precedent set for. But my GP that I go to, I handpicked her because her parents were circus people.
Yeah.
And their circus people are like sailors or something. They're very superstitious. They love things. So she kind of gets stuff, but I get some looks from her sometimes, even like, I need to put you on a 72-hour psych hold.
Like, yeah, I know. Exactly. No, I know. That is one of the issues about being an empath, about being someone that has what I call in and out psychic abilities, someone who's even clairaudient. I mean, even the other day I had a message come to me as being a clairaudient, which is you kind of hear messages. Now, they a psychiatrist would say, oh, you're schizophrenic, I need to put you on medication. I said, no, that's not the same thing as what I'm having. I literally have things relayed to me that are either helping me or beneficial or whatever. I tell this story all the time too. I have won 18 casino jackpots in the last four years.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, people are like, well, how do you do that? I said, well, someone talks to me. They tell me turn left, turn right, and then they say sit your butt down. And then I go and I sit my butt down at a machine that they say sit down. And I'm like, okay, I'll sit down here, although it's not a machine I normally would play, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is that I don't have any God-given talent to be able to go into a casino and be able to pick out firsthand the winning slot machine. But apparently I do. But the thing is I hear it clairaudiently coming to me. So you see, they would put me on medication for that and say, you're hearing voices. Oh, you're schizophrenic. Oh, no, I'm not.
And I've kind of had the same experience, but it wasn't voices, but I lived in Las Vegas for 8 years.
Oh, you did?
And there'd be times when I'd be in the casino just wandering around, I'd think, I need to play that machine there. Mm-hmm. And the voice would be mine and say, I need to play that one. Mm-hmm. And I'd sit down and play it. I didn't win any really big jackpots, but I always walked out with some of the casino's money in my pocket.
Yeah.
And I'd get those, loyalty cards.
Yeah.
And some of those, like the locals' casinos, like the Gold Coast and some of those, they get $20 a month. To go play it. I took some nice wins out of there. And Palace Station was another one.
Yeah.
I couldn't sleep one night. About 2 o'clock in the morning, I went down to Palace Station. That was the nearest casino to where I was living there on West Sahara. Mm-hmm. And took $200. I said, I'm going to, this is it.
Yeah.
When it's gone, it's gone. Mm-hmm. Just as the sun was coming up, I walked out with $1,500 of the casino's money.
There you go.
And I played stuff I'd never played before, like what's the three-card poker?
Yeah.
There's absolutely no skill in that.
No.
I wouldn't even look at the cards. I just, I bet this.
Right.
And then, boom, you got it.
Yeah.
I really only had to beat the dealer and I think whoever else. I still to this day, I don't know how to play it, but I wanted that. I wanted the slots.
Mm-hmm.
And, started with 200, left with 15.
Mm-hmm.
Called in sick to work. And then went to Fry's Electronics and bought a new laptop with that money. That was something I always did. Anytime I won even a few hundred dollars, I would go buy something with it. I wouldn't gamble it back in. I'd take so much. Once this is gone, I'm not going to play anymore. I'm not, you don't throw good money after bad. That's how you go broke.
Right.
And as often as I could, I used that, the $20, like at the Gold Coast, they'd send me that.
Mm-hmm.
And it would tell you on your little card how much more you had to gamble before you could cash out.
Mm-hmm.
You had to at least spend what they had put on there for you. You couldn't go in and just take their 20 and leave. But good luck.
Have you ever found that you mentioned it really earlier in our conversation, and I kind of picked up on it, but I wanted to just briefly touch on it again. So I am most activated when I'm very, very tired, very, very fatigued, just waking up or right in the middle of a dream or something like that. Then I find, oddly enough, that sometimes I get flashes in my head. They're very quick flashes, flash, flash, flash. And sometimes they show themselves as pictures or whatever. Like before I won a very large, over $3,000, I was just waking up. I saw a picture of a buffalo flash through my head. Well, there's many popular buffalo machines these days. So you just, which one do I choose, right? And I don't know. I just kind of grogged my way to one. And then within like 15 spins, I won the, $3,000+.
That's
but the
awesome.
Thing is that my question to you is, do you find yourself more activated when you are very, very tired and fatigued? Yeah,
absolutely. I'm lifelong insomniac. Mm-hmm. I rarely sleep more than 2 hours a night.
Yeah.
But I've noticed if I've been up at least 24 hours or more, the longer I go, the more I become aware of something out there.
Mm-hmm.
And my sleeping mechanism is broken anyway. Mm-hmm. When I do go to sleep, I go right into REM sleep. There's no stages for me. A lot of times I'm dreaming before I've even shut my eyes and I see things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I get cognitive flashes of that, but not always. Sometimes it's something that just, you know, that my brain has just made up to entertain itself, I think, because it's
interesting,
weird or strange. But
yeah,
it's right in my, the one I described about the seeing the pipes roll over the guy. Oh, I just laid down then and then boom, and it was, and I hadn't been asleep 2 minutes.
That's right.
I couldn't go back to sleep because it was so horrifying.
Well, and the thing is you, and then you hear about it, right? Mm-hmm. Then you see it, and then it's like, you know, that's exactly right. I had a past life regression done when I had that handprint show up on my body. And I wanted to find out if I could see the alien or whatever it was that put it there. Well, I was too paranoid being in the therapist's office because I had three ghosts sitting on the couch watching all of this. I had a black mask over my face and I was just too paranoid to want to do anything. But the moral of the story is, I left there severely depressed, which is one of the things that can happen if you have a past life regression done. Well, of course, when I go home, I predict 10 sports plays in a row, could tell my husband exactly in baseball where they're going to hit the ball, what was going to happen, who's going to catch it, who's going to throw it, if there's going to be a mishap. And then, of course, right after the baseball game was the Kentucky Derby. And for the past 3 years, I predicted the winning horse, and I don't follow horses.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many things about the state of mind that you're in when you activate. Now, not everybody probably activates when they're highly fatigued, but because you kind of mentioned that, I thought, oh, you're
I think it's because when I let my guard down,
yeah,
and I let it just flow freely, because it's not something I can do on command or on demand. I've had people try that. Oh, well, tell me what I'm thinking. You know, one of those,
I'm
not a mind
reader. I'm not either. I'm not either.
That's almost insulting to me. Well, when people are like, I'm some sort of trick pony or something. No, it just comes. I can't make it come. I can't make it show up.
Right.
In fact, trying to make stuff happen, it'll never show up.
Right.
It's just when you least expect it.
Right.
Oh, okay, wow, what was that?
Right.
Try to pay attention to it and
decipher
it. My grandmother was always big on threes. If you dream something three times,
oh, here we go.
Experience something.
It's called semiotics. Yep.
And she'd say that anything, if it happens three times, if you dream it three times, if you actually see it, if you see the same crow three times or this, or pay attention to anything that happens in threes, that's something trying to tell you something.
Yeah.
Whether good or bad.
Yeah, I agree with that. We call it the rule of threes. It's something there's a course in it, and I was in it for my master's program. And it's a big deal. It's called the rule of threes. And I agree with you. I always go, there's strike one. Oh, there's strike two. And I don't want strike three, especially if it's going to be something negative. Now, if it's something positive, I would be going, where's my third strike? But I agree with you on the rule of threes there too. Tell us just a little bit more, if you can hang on with me in this interview. I don't want to take up all your time today, but for those of you that are watching right now, this is going to also be played on a podcast. And I can already tell you right now that this is going to be a doubleheader. So I'm just saying that. But for those of you watching us right now, this is a straight through conversation. And so you'll get the full benefit today. So I just wanted to let you know, Steve, that this has gone into a doubleheader. And I don't want to take up all your time, but I want to just tell you that you made my grade. Okay. So I do have a question for you, though.
Sure.
So let's talk a little bit about your writing now. Let's talk a little bit about the fascination with these missing disappearances and these national parks and the books that you've written. Because I just had a conversation with a couple individuals, especially when it involves 411 disappearances or anything like that. And just the mystery of you know, we talk about Bigfoot and we talk about, could it have happened from this or could it have happened from that? So give us an idea as to how you fell into these. You write about missing persons and disappearances. How did you fall into that? And then where did that all begin for you?
Now, again, that goes back to childhood. Mm-hmm. I was 5 going on 6 years old, 1969.
Wow.
And Dennis Martin, little boy from Knoxville, Tennessee, went missing in the Great Smokies National Park. Mm-hmm. He was around my age. I said I was 5 going on 6. He was 6 going on 7.
Okay.
Father's Day, he'd gone up into an area above Cades Cove known as Spence Field with his father, his brother, and his grandfather. It's kind of a boy's day out for Father's Day. And I won't go into the whole story because that one's got a lot of twists and turns. Mm-hmm. You could probably fill a whole book with the circumstances of that case. But that was the first time that in my little mind that, you know, I realized that, you know, kids can go missing. Bad things can happen. There's mm-hmm. everybody doesn't have a happy ending or a fairy tale story. Mm-hmm. And every day I'd watch the papers to see if there's any news of him. And back then, Knoxville had 2 newspapers. The Knoxville News Sentinel was the evening paper. And the Knoxville Journal was a morning paper. And every day I'd look for any news about Dennis. And somewhere, I think my sister-in-law has them. I've got 2 scrapbooks full of clippings where I clip stuff out for over a year. Mm-hmm. And to this day, every year around the anniversary of his disappearance, the local news will talk about him and stuff. But I just, you know, that stayed with me the whole time. Mm-hmm. And I would think about Dennis from time to time. And when it had first happened, and again, in my 5-year-old mind, like, well, we don't live that far from the Smokies. We're like an hour away. Of course, that was an hour by car.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, maybe wander down here somewhere. So I'm out on this little country road where we live on, riding my Schwinn Stingray, looking in the bushes to see if I could find this lost boy. Mm-hmm. And I even left like some chips and some little snack crackers or something out in the woods in case he was lost and scared. And, mm-hmm. you know, of course, they never found any trace of him. Mm-hmm. But I had made a video about that a few years ago. I'd gone ahead, I just can turn into a long story. I'd written my first book, Strange Things in the Woods. Mm-hmm. That was stories I'd collected from people. I've got a lot of things that didn't happen in the woods, mm-hmm. but that was a common theme in a lot of these stories. Mm-hmm. So I gathered those into a book and actually turned out I had enough. I had more Strange Things in the Woods, mm-hmm. and I would go on different podcasts and radio shows and stuff. And invariably the host or somebody in the audience, if it was a call-in show, would ask, well, these are other people's experiences. Have you ever experienced anything? And I'm like, oh, well, let me tell you. And I trot out one story or another, mm-hmm. and I started thinking, well, maybe I've got enough to fill a book. And I did. And that's My Strange World. I don't think I sent you a picture of the cover of that one.
I've got that. Now, I mean, I took it. I mean,
that's my own personal experiences there. And I've got enough to do another one at some point. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I'd written those 3 at that time. Now, Strange Things in the Woods and More Strange Things in the Woods, mm-hmm. when I went with their traditional publisher, they've been combined into 1 volume.
Yeah.
But I decided I wanted to do YouTube, mm-hmm. and I knew some people that were doing like the horror narration and stuff, mm-hmm. and they would either pay people to write stories for them or beg permission from somebody off Reddit to do like a creepypasta. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, you big dummy, you've got 3 books sitting here that you could mm-hmm. narrate. So I started narrating my own stuff from my books,
yeah.
and I'd made one. After I ran out of stories, I started looking for stuff to do, mm-hmm. and I thought I'd do a series on the disappearances in the Great Smokies, because mm-hmm. there was not only Dennis, there was a girl named Trini Gibson mm-hmm. that went missing in the 70s. Mm-hmm. We went to rival high school. She was a couple years older than me, but it turned out my niece, my brother's other kid, was friends with her sister, Tina. So I talked to Tina, got the scoop on Trini's disappearance. I actually had seen Trini. She worked at a cafeteria in Westtown Mall. She was the girl that would carry her trays to the table. My parents liked to eat there, so I'd seen her on occasion. Mm-hmm. Thelma, Pauline Melton, that went missing in the Smokies in 1981, I think. Mm-hmm. The hiking and skiing club I was a member of at the time actually volunteered. We volunteered to go and participate in the search effort for. So these aren't cases that I just knew of or found out about. I have a personal connection to at least those 3. Now there's more from the Smokies that I've written about, but I don't have as much of a personal connection. Mm-hmm. And I'd done a series on those. And Bill Melder, the guy that started Missing Persons and Mysteries, mm-hmm. Which I'm co-owner of now, he brought me in as a full partner. Mm-hmm. He had heard that I did. And he said, I like your voice. He's not quite my age. He's in his 40s, I think. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't like the way he sounds, which I don't think anybody does. I don't like the way I sound. But for whatever reason, people like my voice. I get compliments on my voice. Mm-hmm. It's calming. People with like to listen. People that have PTSD, people that have insomnia, fibromyalgia, chronic pain, things like that. So he heard this and he said, well, come over to my channel and narrate. He was going to hire me to narrate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would get that occasionally in the comments. Somebody's, oh, come to my channel. Yeah. And then you look and they've got like 20 subscribers or something. Yeah. Well, I went and looked at Missing Persons and Mysteries and he had like, I think like 8 or 10,000 at the time, which to me, that was a lot. I'm like, wow, okay, I'm in. And I started recording some videos and it just absolutely blew up, took off. This was about 2 years ago. And just last week, we hit 204,000 subscribers. Wow. It took like about a year, year and a half to get the first 100,000.
Yeah.
And then just a few months to get the next 100,000.
Yeah.
And we're gaining about 10,000 a month. So,
wow.
So we'll see where that goes. But that was how I got into this. And mm-hmm. I said it was something I'd been aware of, but not to the extent that I am now, just how many missing persons cases and things there are.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Yosemite. That's the number one spot. There's more people missing out of Yosemite than anywhere.
Yeah.
Even though the Smokies is the most visited, even during lockdown, Smokies had 12 million visitors. But Yosemite, I think they had like 5 million, but there's more people missing from there. And it's just, it's on and on. Recently, one of my latest videos, I went up on Mount Rainier and did some research up there into some of those missing person cases. And that was the first video where I've actually put myself in the video to do the intro and the outro. Yeah. So everybody wondered what I looked like as they'd hear this voice. And then I got all this, well, you look exactly like I thought you would.
I know,
so that's a good thing. So I'm going to be doing more of those at the end of the month. I'm going up to Olympic National Park, another strange place. A lot of missing up there in the national park and in the national forest. Mm-hmm. There's even tales of occult activity up there, so-called devil worship or satanic activity. Mm-hmm. Going to go up there and look into that a little bit, shoot some footage.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just blew up from there. And I decided, my publisher said, well, you know, why don't you write about these missing persons and stuff? And I'm like, well, you know, I could. So, Bill and I wrote the first book about the Smokies by myself. And it's not just missing people.
Right.
It's not like the missing 411 books where it's just the missing people with a certain theme. I've got local legends. I've got ghost lore. I've got Cherokee legends. Mm-hmm. Anything in the Smokies, unsolved murders, mm-hmm. anything I could remember that I was aware of in the Smokies went into that book.
Mm-hmm.
And then volume two is California. And then talk mm-hmm. about Yosemite. And Mount Shasta, which is one of my favorite places to go visit, mm-hmm. headed back there this fall.
Mm-hmm.
And Joshua Tree, Bill, the founder of the channel, my partner over there, he actually went missing for 5 days in Joshua Tree and encountered what he thought were shadow beings. But the more he described them to me, they sound like alien greys.
Yeah.
But something was after him out there.
So that was a friend of yours? That was a friend of yours.
Yeah, that's the co-founder, the founder of the YouTube channel, the one that I'm partners with now.
So when he went missing, I mean, I don't know how much you can share, but I think people are intrigued at this point and stuff. What did he experience?
Well, it was like a bewilderment and not knowing where he was, nothing looked familiar, not being able to find his way back.
Huh.
And this had happened right. He was in the grieving process. It was after his mom had died. Story's in the book, and we've got a video about it on the channel. So, but he said he felt a call. He said like something was drawing him.
Yeah,
Joshua Tree. He's like, I need to go there. He was living in California at the time.
Yeah,
and Joshua Tree is just kind of strange. Anyway, it's one of the founders of the rock band the Eagles. They used to go out there and, with the assistance of psychedelic substances, watch for UFOs and things.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a strange place anyway. He said Joshua Tree's everybody's power spot.
Mm-hmm.
And Graham Parsons, another country rock musician,
mm-hmm.
when he passed away from an overdose at the Joshua Tree Inn,
mm-hmm.
his road manager went and stole the body off the tarmac. He was headed back to Louisiana to be buried in the family plot.
Oh,
his road manager and another person went and stole the body off the tarmac at LAX and set it on fire at Joshua Tree under Cap Rock. Well, that was, they made a pact that whoever died first, the other was going to give the living or the deceased one a Viking send off.
Oh my.
So Graham died first. His road manager kept his promise, took the body out there, the casket and everything, a gallon of gas, a match. Poof, he released Graham's spirit into the desert.
God.
But his spirit's out there, room 8 at the Joshua Tree Inn, where he passed away. I've stayed there, and you can still feel him there. And it's kind of creepy. There's a couple of things that are still in the room that were in there when he passed away.
Yeah.
One of them is a mirror, and mirrors give me the creeps anyway. And
you're
sitting there, and you're looking at that mirror, and maybe catch your eye, and you're thinking, you know, the last time Graham Parsons ever saw himself alive was in that mirror.
Yeah.
So it's just, but anyway, Bill went out there for whatever reason, being drawn there, and he just kind of was wandering around the desert, became lost. I can't remember all the details right off the top of my head. It's in the book, but he didn't have food or water or anything with him. And almost died.
Yeah.
And he said there was a couple times when he curled up and sort of made a hole and said, yeah, I'm literally digging my own grave. This is where I'm going to die.
Yeah.
Well, at night, these entities, and he said they were shadow people. They were dark. You couldn't see through them. But when he described them to me, it sounded that shape-wise, they were like alien grays, except black. They had the big head and the spindly limbs and small trunk and stuff.
Yeah.
But he said they would like come up and peer at him. And then when he startled or looked at him, they would skitter away. And then he would start to doze back off, and they would come closer to him again and run away.
Wow.
And finally, he awakened to a park ranger literally pouring water down his throat, woke up choking, and the guy said, there's a lot of people looking for you, buddy.
Oh, my.
But, he spent some time in the hospital. In the video that we have, we've got the news video of it where he was lost and found there. But it's a very compelling story.
Right.
And that's not an unusual thing when you start looking to these disappearances.
Mm-hmm.
There's people that end up somewhere where they weren't just a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
They don't recognize anything. The trail they're on is gone.
Yeah.
It's not behind them, and they were just on it.
Yeah.
Sometimes they can hear searchers, even see them off in the distance.
Yeah.
But no matter how much they yell or wave their hands,
they
it's like the other people can't see
them.
There's people that have made it back. And that was what I talked about at the UFO conference in San Francisco.
Yeah.
I'm not a UFO person at all, but I found a parallel between people that have been abducted and their experiences, what they remember, and people that have been lost and didn't know where they were. It was in a strange or different place when they came back. A lot of the experiences kind of dovetail together. So that's one of the theories, that it's aliens or UFOs that's taken people.
Mm-hmm.
There's people that believe it's Bigfoot or some kind of cryptid that takes people. There's other people that believe that it's our own government or some government doing things, taking people for experimentation. A lot of people that go missing tend to be either very, very highly educated, like PhDs, or on the lower end of the autism spectrum. People that are very athletic, marathoners, mountaineers, people with a lot of experience in the woods. And literally some of these, they walked out of sight, where they rounded a curve in the trail, never seen again, no trace.
Yeah.
Some people that are found deceased. They're often found near boulder fields, berry patches. One guy that we covered, he was found in a boulder field, and he looked like he'd been dropped from considerable height, although it was a flat field. There was nowhere to be dropped from a height. Well, the Algonquin Indians in New England, they have a story about a creature that lives in the woods that can disguise itself as a rock. And when you walk by, it opens up, it swallows you, and gets whatever it gets out of your nutrients or something, then it spits you back out. And I thought about that. If some rock creature indeed swallows you, crushed you, and spits you back out, you might look like you'd fallen from a great height. There was also a body found in that area, New England, where they said the guy looked like he'd been crushed to death, and he was just in the middle of the woods. But same area, there's also Bigfoot sightings. Back in the 1800s, one turned a stagecoach over, peered in at the people, and then screamed and ran away. I guess he didn't like what he saw. And then there's other people that The Fae theory is a very interesting. My friend Jemma Jade, who writes for the channel, she wrote a book about the missing and the Fae theory. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the most outlandish theory, but also the one that ties everything together. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you talk about the Fae, people will laugh at you. People that believe in Bigfoot and UFOs will snicker at you if you talk about fairies. Mm-hmm. But if you look at, especially in some of the Celtic countries and things like that, the fairies was almost a religion over there at one point, the fairy folk. People left things out for them. People did things to keep them away or to not make bargains with them and things. But if you look at the Fae theory and some of those experiences from back then, one account that I read talked about little men in a horseless carriage that came from the sky. Well, that's a UFO sighting. Mm-hmm. Where they talk about one type of the Fae is a hairy beast that's tall. Well, there's Bigfoot. The natives have the Pukwudgie and I can't remember what they call it in the Cherokee. Mm-hmm. But the Cherokee have those stories of the little people who they were at war with, they made peace with. Mm-hmm. They've got stories of big hairy beings. They've got stories of what fairy people call the fairy lanterns, the lights in the woods that seem to move on their own. So as much as it sounds ridiculous, the Fae kind of ties everything together with Bigfoot, UFOs. I gave a talk about that at the Conspiranormal Conference in Nashville last year. I tied together Bigfoot, UFOs, the fairies, cargo cults, these Bigfoot nests that people find in the woods, pyramids, the Tower of Babel, and a couple other things that I was able to connect all these dots. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's easy to connect the dots in reverse.
It's really interesting, mysterious, and sometimes not explainable to a point. You know, sometimes when I think about how I bounced on the bed at Groveland Hotel just outside of Yosemite, there was one point where I was thinking to myself, maybe I didn't have a disgruntled apparition that didn't like someone snoring in the bed, because I could have sworn that I felt kind of a foot underneath my back. The other thing that I had started thinking about was it was an incredibly clear night, brilliant stars in the sky, very everything. And then I thought to myself, could it even be possible that I could have been lifted out of bed, or I don't know.
Take it out, and then when they dropped you back in, they dropped me too soon, and you bounced off the bed.
I bounced.
I thought about that.
Yes, I know.
And an abduction experience.
Think about the conditions. Think about what the strongest rays are there. That one hit me, by the way, that whole thought, because I've got 11 books out there on my personal accounts, with the exception of a few, of all these things that have happened to me, and it's like, okay, now I've been kicked up in the air. Okay, now I got a mark on my body. Okay, now I've done this and whatever. It seems like every time I turn around, something else is happening so I can write about it. You know what I mean? And so, but I did rethink that story, and I thought, maybe I was dropped from, maybe they tried to bring me through the roof. I was a little heavier then than I am now. Maybe they just couldn't get me through the ceiling and they decided to just drop me. I mean, it's
fair. It's just the stuff that I've seen and personally experienced. I don't discount anything.
Oh, no.
You could tell me the most wild, outlandish story and I'd think, no. Could happen. I can see it. And usually, I mean, not always, there's some very skilled liars out there, but usually you can tell when somebody's hoaxing or making something up or what their motivation is and things like that. The ones that are the most believable to me are the ones you kind of have to coax it out of them. They seem embarrassed by the whole thing.
Exactly.
That maybe haven't told their wife or their kids. Mm-hmm. That, to me, that's the ones that that really stand out. I'm not saying that, the others are fake or anything, but those seem the most genuine to me. The least embellished.
You try convincing your husband of this in the first years of your marriage that something is up, right? And then all of a sudden he starts seeing this stuff along with you, or experiencing this stuff along with you. Now, most people ask me this question. When you have the experiences of like bouncing back in the bed, wouldn't your husband have awakened at that time if he would have felt the you bouncing on the bed?
Not necessarily. He could have been under some sort of spell or something.
That's correct. I was on my couch in one of my former homes, and right in front of me, I became a little disoriented, dizzy for the moment. Don't know what was happening, but I knew the house was haunted. Right in front of me, in a kind of like a coffee cup kind of thing, my spoon started going, whipping around the cup. Where was my husband the whole time? He was sleeping on the couch. I started banging at him. Wake up, wake up. Look at this. The spoon is going around in the cup. And of course, I couldn't wake him up. I could not wake him up the night that I was bouncing on the bed. I could not wake him up when at the point we were going to bed and the cycling mirror was happening in the haunted room I was staying in. He went to sleep, but he was very odd. There was something about him that was not his personality and went really cold on me in a very odd way. And I thought, no, something in here has a hold on him. But I agree with you. It's like,
there was a house that I lived in Las Vegas that was built in the 1930s, and it was close to downtown, but back at the time when everything in Las Vegas was downtown on Fremont Street in that area before the strip, strips didn't start till the 40s, but if this house was built in the 30s, at that time it would have been out in the middle of the desert.
Right.
And I found out later that it was indeed a mob safe house. Yeah. Well, there was times, it was usually when I was alone, I would hear what sounded like somebody dragging a metal garbage can full of scrap metal up and down the wooden hallway.
Yeah.
And it'd be like, I'd be there by myself. I'd be in the bathtub or something. I'd hear this noise. I'd get up, get my robot, go out there, nothing.
Yeah.
And then there was one other time when my roommate was actually there. She was asleep in her room and it sounded like somebody was tearing the house down. Mm-hmm. There was footsteps on the roof. Mm-hmm. There was stuff in the hallway, the door slamming, all this weird stuff was happening. She slept through every bit of it. And you think about that, it's almost like some kind of like a supernatural sleep or something, like something's been put over them. She didn't hear anything. She was a light sleeper.
Right.
And didn't see or hear anything. And she didn't even believe that the house was haunted. Mm-hmm. But what made her a believer, I had the basement. I had a photography studio set up down there. And sometimes I would do these model of portfolio sessions. Mm-hmm. Well, she came in from somewhere one time, and she said she heard what sounded like a party going on downstairs. Yeah. Now, a lot of times when I would have those big sessions, because this was a really nice house, is several thousand square feet, and the back opened into like a park-like area, French doors out of the basement. I'd have a DJ, I would have it catered, I'd have hair and makeup, have maybe a dozen models come in, get them all prepped up, shoot them stuff for their portfolio, and just kind of make a big party out of it. So she thought I was having a portfolio shoot. She walks down to go downstairs. You had to go down the stairs, hit a landing that also went out in the backyard, and then continue down more stairs. And about the time she hit the landing, she noticed there's no lights on down there. So she took a few tentative steps farther toward the basement, and then everything stopped. Went totally silent. She goes, looks, turns on the lights. There's nothing down there. She calls me on my cell phone. I'm out at Red Rock. I've been out there since before daylight, getting ready to do a shoot when the sun came up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I've been home. I've been gone since 6 o'clock this morning. And she's like, is it okay if I come out there with you? And but whatever she heard spooked her. And she said at one point it almost sounded like people singing or chanting. Well, one day I was out getting the mail, and I've got this habit. If I've got interesting mail, I'll stand there at the box and open it and read it. I was doing that one day. And I kind of felt something. I looked around, and there's an old man standing there just staring at me. And I'm like, can I help you?
Yeah.
And he's like, pardon me for staring. He said, but I just wonder what kind of person could live in that house. And I'm like, okay, we need to talk.
Oh, my God.
I invited him in for coffee. And he had lived on that street since the early 50s, like 1951 or 52. And he knew the history of the house. It had indeed built as a mob safe house. There was a hidden room. As you went down that second flight of stairs, there was a bookcase in the wall that opened up, single or simple concrete room single bulb on a cord and a drain in the floor. Yeah. I believe there were people that went in that room and didn't come out in one piece.
Oh my.
But he said it had indeed been a mob safe house. And he said that then in the 70s, there was some kind of cult that lived there and actually used it as a church. The part of the basement where she thought she'd heard a crowd mm-hmm. was where they had their services. And it was, the more I thought about it, there was a window in the wall that went from one room to the other. Mm-hmm. And then inside that room, there was like where the pulpit would be. There was recesses in the walls, yeah, like where you put candles. Yeah. And then there was an archway there that just went a little way back in the wall. And I could say, okay, yeah, somebody stood here and preached. And then somebody handed something out through the window into the room where the congregants were. But I think that's what she was hearing, that something that had went on there in the past. But there's a lot of activity there. And there's the girls that modeled for me were witches, self-professed witches. And they wanted to hold a seance there.
Oh.
And I let them come and do a seance. Mm. And they contacted some guy who claimed that he'd been murdered in the basement, but he wasn't a snitch. He wouldn't tell them who he was, right, what he was doing there, why he got whacked or anything.
Right.
So there you go. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you there.
No. I don't want to interrupt you. I could talk to you like for 15 hours. Okay. I mean, I was just going to, but for a moment there, the way you were describing the place and the house, I was going to go, are you describing Red Fox's house by chance? Have you heard of Red Fox's house? Yeah,
I've been to Red Fox's house. It's when yeah. I lived there, it was, I think it's a real estate or
yeah, yeah.
insurance company or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Went there Halloween night and we saw some strange things there. Now, supposedly it's not as active because they painted the big red fox on the outside of it to appease his ghost.
Yeah.
But prior to that, and he had supposedly said that, he got in a lot of trouble with the IRS back before they were his.
Yeah.
Supposedly the kinder, gentler IRS now, but they took his house.
Yes.
And that really upset him. And yeah. he said, when I die, I'm not going to heaven or hell. I'm going to come back and haunt my house.
Yeah.
And sure enough, he did.
He did. And he also had parties in the backyard in his pool. And the pool would be completely bone dry. And it would sound as if there's splashing around and people back there, you know, having a party in the pool and carrying on and everything like that. Obviously, since you've lived in Vegas, and of course, I'm in Vegas at least 2-3 times a year, and I have a lot of haunted experiences in Vegas every time I'm there. And I still think also extraterrestrial, because I am a firm believer. My first real extraterrestrial experience happened in, and people have heard me say the name, I won't say it on this show, but in one of the more fancier, nicest hotels on the 60th floor. So that's the only hint I'll give you, where I believe I actually had my very first extraterrestrial experience there. But it is a place that I tell people all the time, there is so much energy there. There is so much, the energy of people just coming there, the people there that never leave there, the people there that are buried out in the desert and we don't know where they're buried there. Yeah. You know,
lately, I've been finding all those bodies in Lake Mead too, or Lake Mead. Some of them that have been there since, one guy they pulled out, they thought he'd been there since the 70s based on what he was wearing.
Yeah.
But the most intense UFO sighting I ever had was at the south end of the strip.
Yeah.
If you keep going past Mandalay Bay till you get, before you get to those other places, there's a power station down there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was working at Treasure Island at the time. Mm-hmm. And I'd gotten off about 2:00 in the morning mm-hmm. and was I was a manager. I was taking one of my employees, giving a ride home down to Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
And we went down that way. Mm-hmm. And we saw, Kelly, it was this big triangular craft. It was blacker than the sky.
Yeah.
And it was just hovering over this power station there.
Yeah.
And it looked as big as a football field, triangular shape, no lights, no noise, nothing. I actually pulled over. The girl I was getting a ride to, she saw it too.
Mm-hmm.
We stood there, watched it maybe 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Stock still. And then all of a sudden it just went with no noise or anything, but it just went just up and gone, out of sight. I mean, it would have had to have gone several hundred miles an hour to be there and then not.
How long ago was this?
That would have been, trying to think when I lived in Vegas, probably 2007 or 8, something like that.
I will tell you, Mr. 2 hour, here we go, people. You know, I hope y'all grabbed your own popcorn because I certainly could go on forever. But I want you now, Steve, to tell everybody a little bit about how what you've got out, what's going on, any events, any books, the whole 10 yards, how they can get a hold of you. And I will have all of this in the show notes at the end of this show.
Awesome. Well, my main YouTube channel is Missing Persons and Mysteries. Mm-hmm. So we just passed 204,000 subscribers over there. Mm-hmm. Put out 2 or 3 videos a week anyway. The emphasis will always be on missing persons. If we can bring one person home or give one family closure, then we've done our job. But yeah. Now the mystery side of that, we do get into the paranormal and the woo-woo stuff a little bit here and there, cryptids, ghost stories. One of our most popular segments is listener stories, where people write in their own personal experiences, and it can be anything as long as it happened to you or somebody you know. Yeah. That's my main channel. Got a personal channel, 13 Past Midnight. Do a lot of ghost stories. Some of my original narrations from the books are over there. It's a much smaller channel. It's not even 9,000 subscribers, I think.
Oh, good.
And find me on Twitter, at Strange and Odd. Mm-hmm. And then I'm on Facebook, Steve Stockton 81. Mm-hmm. And then that's also my email address, stevestockton81@gmail.com. Okay. Love hearing from people, hearing your stories. Mm-hmm. If you just want to tell me a story, or if you want me to put it in a listener story, happy to do that. Mm-hmm. My books, Strange Things in the Woods, like I said, that's 2 volumes combined now. My Strange World is my personal experiences. And then I've got volumes 1, 2, and 3 of the National Park Mysteries and Disappearance. Mm-hmm. Volume 1 is the Great Smokies. Volume 2 is California. And like I said, that includes Yosemite, Joshua Tree, and Mount Shasta. I'll probably do another book or two just on California. Mm-hmm. The third volume of that is the Pacific Northwest up here where I'm at now. It includes Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. Mm-hmm. And I've got another book coming out probably in July about the missing and murdered Indigenous women. Mm-hmm. One of my writers for the channel, Sandy Lewis, and I, she's also my travel companion. Mm-hmm. We decided to do a book on that. It's just, there's thousands and thousands of women missing in the U.S. and Canada. Mm-hmm. It's especially in Canada, as part of what they call the Highway of Tears, where these Indigenous women just go missing and nobody seems to care. I mean, a lot of times even the local government, because of jurisdictional issues and things, you don't hear a lot about it. But, mm-hmm. you know, like, say, for example, the Gabby Petito case. Now, she was an influencer, so she had mm-hmm. fans and things, but blonde-haired, blue-eyed white girl goes missing, it's international news.
Yeah.
And then yet here there's thousands of Native women that you never hear anything about. So we're trying to bring that to light. Mm-hmm. We have a video series about that too that we're doing called Spirited Away. Mm-hmm. That's getting good response. A lot of people just had no idea. And as a part of that, since we're delving into true crime with that, we do have a true crime channel coming soon. And Sandy and I will also be in October at the Pacific Northwest True Crime Festival mm-hmm. in Auburn, Washington. Mm-hmm. So that's, I'm looking forward to that. I've never been to a true crime convention. Yeah. And that's on the event center is there, is on the campus of Green River College. And Green River is, that's Gary Ridgway country, the Green River Killer. That was his area where he operated. Mm-hmm. Then back up a little bit in August, I'm going to be at the first annual Dogman Cryptid Conference in Paris, Tennessee. Josh Turner from Paranormal Roundtable mm-hmm. putting that on. A lot of big names are going to be there. David Weatherly.
Oh, wow.
Ken Gerhardt.
Mm-hmm.
And like a dozen more that I can't think of their names right now, but that one's going to be just totally, totally fascinating.
Yeah, that's going to be
and,
well,
I do get out and travel around and do things for the channel. Said a couple of weeks ago, I was up on Mount Rainier shooting some footage. I had a meet and greet in Yakima. Just a small crowd showed up, but had a lot of fun doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Next trip out, Sandy and I are going up to Washington State, going to be going to Olympic National Park, Olympic National Forest, mm-hmm. be in the Port Angeles, Port Townsend area, probably have a meet and greet up there. We're going to swing back down to Bainbridge Island, take the ferry over to Seattle and back through Yakima again because we had such a good time mm-hmm. there.
Mm-hmm.
And the books are on Amazon or wherever fine books are sold. You can order them at some bookstores have them, some don't. The strangest one I've found in the wild, somebody sent me a picture of one they saw at a Target store. So you never know. Powell's books here in Portland has them. But had a lot of fun writing them. Said you wrote yours in the casino. I wrote mine, the Brunk. I had notes and things, but the majority of the first book I wrote on an iPad with my thumbs riding the commuter trains out here in Portland where I had like a 2-hour commute.
Oh, my.
But now I've been blessed, YouTube and the books. That's all I do full time.
Yeah, it's easier.
Love every minute of it. It's work, I mean, but it's not. When you love what you do, and my dad told me that when I was a kid. Find something you love to do and find a way to get paid for it, and you'll never work again. So
honestly, fascinating stuff. And please, everybody, seek him out. Now, I can't remember, Beyond the Fray Publishing and also Amazon, is this kind of the two?
Yeah, Beyond the Fray is the publisher, and then they've got the books listed on Amazon.
And Steve, thank you so very much
for having me on.
My goodness, doubleheader.
I could have gone another hour.
I know, me too. I'm just like, honestly, and you and I have a lot of similarity here.
Yeah,
that's kind of interesting.
Kind of a twinning thing there or something.
Because
our experiences, shared experiences.
Very much so. And it's just kind of like, isn't it interesting how sometimes there just aren't any coincidences anymore?
Yeah,
right.
No, I don't think there are any coincidences, really. I don't.
Nope, and we're all learning every day, and there's things that come to us that we finally realize what their messages are. Well, thank you again. We will have you on, as I tell everybody, in the late future, so we can check back in with you and see what books you're at now, and if you and I can continue on where we left off. So thank you again for being on the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks again, Dr. Kelly.